It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, author and journalist Louis Duguid talks with host Keith Brown Ill about COINTELPRO, FBI surveillance and infiltration of groups they considered subversive. Then, in the second half of our show, Ethan Thampe talks with host Jessica Thomas about the rollout of recreational cannabis in Colorado and Washington, plus the efforts to relax the laws in Missouri. Get your pens and papers ready for our calendar of events in the middle of the show, and as always, the 420 drug war news after the show.
Operation Counter Intelligence Program. FBI Operation Counter Intelligence Program. Every military and law enforcement officer in this country is required to take a sworn oath to uphold and defend the American Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. But many Americans have no idea that the FBI, one of the most trusted and respected law enforcement agencies in this country, has a history of being secretly involved in plots to discredit, falsely imprison, cause the destruction, and sometimes even kill its own law-abiding citizens. My name is Keith Brown Ill, and I'll be your host for Jaws of Justice Radio this morning. And today we are going to be talking about the war waged against political adversaries of the FBI, such as civil rights leaders and people in the Black Power movement. Some of you may be familiar with the name Operation COINTELPRO, which is short for Counterintelligence Program. Stay tuned and you will hear a lot more about it on today's show. In a few seconds, I will be speaking with Mr. Louis Duguid, author of the book Discovering the Real America, and he is here in the studio with me this morning. Operation Counterintelligence Program. FBI Operation Counterintelligence Program.
Good morning, Brother Louis. Welcome to our show.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background, sir?
Well, I work at the Kansas City Star. I've been there since 1977 as a reporter, photographer, and editor of different stripes. I write a column for the newspaper and have written a column since 1987. So 37 years now as a professional journalist. I'm from St. Louis and do a lot of public speaking because it's a way to provide service to people.
Are you involved with any political organizations at this time?
The ethics policy at the Star requires that we not be involved in any kind of politics because as journalists we have to be above even the appearance of a conflict of interest. So I am involved in journalism organizations. I'm a founding member of the Kent City Association of Black Journalists and newsletter editor and treasurer of that organization. And then I'm also involved with the National Association for Multicultural Education.
Are you familiar with the term Operation COINTELPRO? And if so, would you tell us what you know about it?
I know it's one of the many covert programs that the United States has had in place, and it's a way of spying and developing intelligence on its citizens and everybody else.
Do you have any insight into what it consisted of?
J. Edgar Hoover, when he was over the FBI, picked up a lot of intelligence information on some of U.S. citizens. African Americans were target. And part of the reason that black people, 20th century and then into the 21st century, have been targets is because anyone who dares to advocate equal rights and all of the constitutional guarantees for African Americans, as everybody else in this country is seen as un-American, is seen as seditious. And that was Hoover's view. But he also took that view with such persons as Albert Einstein and various other people, because he didn't think that these were individuals who were pushing for the best of America. And they were simply wanting all of the rights and civil liberties that are guaranteed, again, by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, to be applied to everyone. Helen Keller was another person that Hoover saw as seditious.
And who was Helen Keller?
She was someone who literature in the United States made famous as this woman who could neither see, hear, or speak. And born in the late 1800s, came into being with the help of AIDS as a person who was brilliant and someone who was also for women's rights and equal rights for everyone. But she was seen by someone like Hoover and the FBI and various other spying agencies as being against what they saw as the American way. Anytime you challenge the benefits that people who are white and male have always gotten in this country and start to say that other people need to have those same privileges too, then you become seditious.
Are you familiar with some of the tactics that the FBI used during Operation COINTELPRO?
Well, I know that with Dr. King, for instance, they had people positioned microphones everywhere. And they had people who were positioned under his bed even to try to get information of what was going on in the civil rights movement. But I also know that they had individuals who were plants within different organizations such as the Black Panthers and the Vietnam War protests who would instigate issues, problems, and try to get and push these organizations to do things that were just not right.
Okay, now that would involve surveillance, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And also having people to infiltrate the organization. Can you define what the term agent provocateur means?
Well, I only know this in kind of passing, but these are individuals who would ferment different problems and say, man, we need to go and do blah, blah, blah. And then the group, thinking that this is someone who's on their side, may decide that they're going to do it when it's just a setup. So much of U.S. history and problems that the organizations like the Black Panther faced were set up in this way so that they were seen as, instead of groups that were trying to benefit a group of people, they were seen as individuals who were against America.
In other words, they would go out and agitate in concepts that were inconsistent with what the goals of the group was.
Absolutely.
And then try to create a negative image in the minds of the public to turn them against the organizations.
Well, it doesn't take much for mainstream America to look at African Americans and see us as people who are against what they consider the best interest of America. We are a criminal element as promoted by the media and all of the stereotypes and certainly the literature and education. We are people who are underperformers. We are considered the ne'er-do-wells anyway. So it's just a small push to get people to think that black people are against the best interests of this country overall.
Okay, what are some of the other tactics of Operation COINTELPRO that was used by the FBI?
Well, wiretapping, certainly. Surveillance by people who are plants in the organizations. But there were many other different types of things that went on. I mean, certainly the tactics today are much more advanced. I mean, we have computer technology, we have video cameras everywhere. So what had been part of the COINTEL procedure is nothing compared to what's going on now. And I think that we need to be much more concerned about now the violations of civil rights and civil liberties that organizations such as the National Security Agency, but all the other different spying agencies in the United States that are really able to look into every crevice of our life and decide whether, from their viewpoint, we are credible Americans or seditious.
Does there seem to be less concern these days about the government spying on people than it was in years in the past?
I think that there is more of a blasé attitude about it. I mean, if you go into your wallet and you look at your different shopper cards, drugstore cards, different bank cards, credit card, all of those things tell the story about us. They tell of our habits. They tell of what our purchases are and what they might be in the future. They tell how much we're spending and where we're spending it. They tell about our wants and needs. And so people are more attuned to giving out a lot of that personal information, which 30 years ago, we were all just anonymous, amorphous Americans just doing our thing and nobody knew. Now, in addition to all of the personal information that's out there everywhere, the government collected, corporations collected, we are individuals who are picked up on every street corner, in every store, in every walk of life by video cameras that record our presence just about everywhere. We drive down the street and there are surveillance cameras at stoplights. So there is no privacy or even the assumption of privacy. And I think that a lot of people know that. And so when you start talking about the government surveilling people, they're like, so what? And then a lot of people's attitude is, I've got nothing to hide, so what's the problem? But what they don't understand is that X and Y and Z can be added up by anyone who wants to do this kind of crazy math to make it seem like you are un-American. And suddenly, what you see as innocence gets turned against you. And I don't see that a lot of folk understand that. They believe in what James Lowen in his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, is the goodness of government and the goodness of the police force. And there needs to be a wariness, an understanding that maybe we've given too much power to authorities, and that's an issue.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brown Eel, and I am talking this morning with Mr. Louis Dugood, author of the book, Discovering the Real America. Mr. Louis is here today to talk to us about the infamous counterintelligence program of the FBI, which allegedly is no longer still in existence.
Do you feel that people have been sold on the idea that this country is under siege by terrorists and people who want to destroy what we stand for, and they have been made to feel like surveillance and many of the tactics that are being used by the government that are illegal and in violation of the Constitution are necessary in order for us to remain safe?
Since September 11, 2001, I think a lot of people have been sold, as you say, on the notion that we need the government to make us safe. The government needs to take whatever steps it can to do that. But what people don't understand is that we are the government. People are the ones who make government what it is. And we cannot hand over that authority to other folks and expect that our best interests will be ensured. We have to vote and vote often and vote regularly. We have to put people in office who will make sure that our interests are guaranteed. And then we have to stay on top of them to just insist that this is what I want, this is what we need, this is what our community has to have. And if you're not doing it, then we'll get somebody else to do it. Rather than have folks in office who are, part of this Tea Party thing where they say government's bad and yet they are the ones who are milking the government for all it's worth for themselves and the support. Orders, being the big money interests. The big money interests pollute government. They take away from the voice of the people. And when they take away from the voice of the people, people think that they don't have a voice, so people stop getting involved in government. And that's the exact wrong tactic. We need to be more engaged, more involved.
Do you have any knowledge about blackmail tactics being used in Operation COINTELPRO?
Not particularly. I know that there was no floor to what COINTELPRO operations was about. They would stoop to anything, any level. This was part of the Hoover reign, and he was in part thwarted by first Franklin Roosevelt's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, because he saw her as also being part of the folks like Helen Keller and Albert Einstein as someone who the country should be very concerned about, very, very afraid of. But she was the president's wife. She was the first lady. She had a strong voice, but she also was someone who was extremely socially active, and she was looking for, again, a more egalitarian country. But Hoover saw her as being a problem. He tried to take her down on different occasions and failed. But, you know, he also failed when it came to Richard Nixon, and Nixon was the one who said, "You got to go."
Well, a lot of these presidents, they utilized the tactics that J. Edgar Hoover devised. What I was referring to a while ago when I spoke about blackmail was the incident involving Dr. King, where they had planted listening devices and people under his bed or whatever to determine that he had been having some extramarital affairs, and that when him and Hoover had a confrontation, he went to Hoover's office to sit down and have a talk with him, and Hoover revealed that he had this information about him and that he would use it to his advantage if it became necessary, if King went public and talked about certain things that he did not want King to talk about. Now, a lot of the people who went to the March on Washington said it was overrated because they were told when they got there where to go, where to march, what type of signs they could have, and what to say and what not to say. And some of the people from the New African Party, they said it was really a travesty.
Well, again, I know that Hoover used whatever tactics he could to try to force people to do whatever he wanted. And he was constantly trying to take down Dr. King, Malcolm X, etc. And he wasn't above using blackmail to get them to be quiet, because he saw that they posed a threat to the way of life in this country that had always existed, and that's with second-class citizens for African Americans and other people of color. King, fortunately, didn't comply. He decided that he was going to do what he needed to do because of what he saw as being the right thing to do. One of the, I think, strongest points of the civil rights movement was that it was rooted in the church, and the church gave people a greater sense of right and wrong. It wasn't right and wrong according to the laws of man, but it was right and wrong according to the spiritualness that they saw. It created a righteousness among people who were marching for something that was bigger than them.
We know anybody who knew anything about J. Edgar Hoover knew that there was nothing beneath him as far as what he had to utilize to achieve his goals. But what I'm essentially trying to do is go down a list here to give the public some idea of the extremes that they went through. Now, I've also came across information that said that there were many cases when there was harassment by law enforcement officials of family members, friends, and employers, that the law enforcement officials would go to people's jobs and give the employers information that was adverse to the employees, or made up information to try to have these people fired or threatened to be fired.
You have to understand the context of history, again, of the early and middle part of the 20th century. There was a committee in Congress for un-American activities that investigated individuals for what was then deemed as seditious. Individuals who worked in the media, the newspapers, magazines, and later television and radio, had to sign what was called a loyalty oath. People who were working for universities also had to sign loyalty oaths, and that meant that their allegiance was to the way things were in this country and always would be. And it was a very conservative, lockdown approach to everything. And whenever the government got involved and started questioning individuals, they were immediately suspect, because why would the government question folks to begin with, and automatically terminated, or deemed ineffective from there forward. And so that history of this country back then was so toxic that no one really would go against someone like Hoover stepping forward, the whole McCarthy crew in Congress stepping forward and saying, "You are communist." And that just muted everything. I mean, it's part of the Cold War. The Cold War just made this country crazy.
There were also incidents reported about instigating internal conflicts among the members of or some of the same organizations and between other groups. And some of these incidents often resulted in people being killed or assaulted.
And I don't doubt that in the least. There were many mysterious deaths that occurred, many mysterious disappearances that occurred. And again, it was just how things were done. It's not right. It wasn't right then. It's not right now.
Well, do you think that Operation Quarantine Pro may have played a role in a lot of the gang violence that's out in the streets today? We have these groups called Crips and Bloods. We've got Gangster Disciples, Latin Disciples, and some of these groups, they get in these conflicts and they last for years and people are killed in the intervals.
I don't doubt in the least. During the Reagan administration, there was the whole Iran-Contra thing where there were allegations of drugs being run into this country, and it helped to fuel the different international conflicts that were going on in other countries, whether it was Nicaragua or Iran and the war between Iran and Iraq. And some people got convicted, other people got a pass, and yet in the central cities of America, just as you pointed out, there were rivalries between this gang and that gang, or these dealers and those dealers, and the people are the ones who suffer, the people are the ones who lose in that kind of conflict. Folks in government who ferment these kinds of problems, they are out for an end that really benefits them and people who are in allegiance with them. We are the little people. The little people get stepped on. Little people always get stepped on. And that's what folks don't really appreciate. And it's only when they have a voice, when they vote, when they act, when they get involved, write letters, that they can begin to be more active and engaged and have a say in what's going on.
Okay, what about facilitating, encouraging the distribution and use of illegal drugs to foster addiction, set up raids, which would result in arrests and convictions of certain activists in the black nationalist movements?
Again, there was no floor to what went on during the COINTEL operation, whether it was to use provocateurs to get individuals hooked on drugs or get individuals to go deeper into that process. I mean, the more we learn about what took place 50 years ago, 75 years ago, or 30 years ago, the more we are outraged, and we should be.
Well, I enjoyed doing this interview with you, sir. One of the regrets that I have is that there's so much material that needs to be covered in a situation like this, and we never have time to do it on the air. But I do thank you for stopping by the studio today and taking time out to come in and give our audience some insight into these things. But you can find this information anywhere on the internet, and a lot of it is very insightful, and it teaches you about the things. I feel that it's necessary for people to be made aware of these things so we don't fall into these traps again.
Absolutely.
But I do appreciate you coming by. I wanted to ask you one more thing. Could you tell us about some of the books you have written and give us your contact information?
Sure. I'm at the Kansas City Star. People can reach me at 816-234-4723, or email address is ldiuguid@kcstar.com. I've written a couple of books. One is Discovering the Real America, Toward a More Perfect Union, and it goes into some of these issues about government and good government and why we haven't been getting it. The other is called A Teacher's Cry, and it's about ways to improve public schools. The books that brought to the studio that, again, can help people understand this stuff that's going on, and all of these books can be found at the Kansas City Public Library. One is Lies My Teacher Told Me by James W. Lowen, L-O-E-W-E-N, and it's about what people need to know about U.S. history and the power structure of our government. The other is called The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientists, and that's by Fred Jerome. Both of these books, again, as well as my books, are at the Kansas City Public Library.
All right, sir, and again, we thank you for being on our show today. Good luck to you and your endeavors, and thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Now, the calendar for January 27th, 2014. The Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, DESE, is working to transform unaccredited school districts in Missouri. They have collected a number of plans from education organizations, as well as commissioned a study on how they can create the conditions for improvement in student achievement in unaccredited districts. They are holding 4 public meetings for feedback on these plans to help create a statewide plan for intervention in unaccredited schools. The public hearing in Kansas City will be on Wednesday, January 29th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Paseo Academy Auditorium, 47 47 Paseo Avenue, KCMO. DESE is also gathering feedback through a form on their website. You can give your feedback on these plans by going to www.dese.mo.gov. Representative Brandon Ellington is holding a public meeting to discuss criminal justice legislation introduced into the 2014 Missouri legislative session. This meeting will take place on Saturday, February 1st, starting promptly at 10:30 a.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. The discussion will include six bills covering issues like parole and probation, eyewitness identification, expungement, child abuse, and more. The UMKC Division of Diversity and Inclusion annual Martin Luther King Jr. keynote lecture features author and columnist Professor Melissa Harris Perry. The lecture will be today, Monday, January 27th at 6 p.m. with a book signing from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. All activities will be in Sweeney Recreational Center, 5030 Holmes Street, KCMO. Parking is available in the Cherry Street parking garage on levels 5 and 6. To learn more, visit umkc.edu/diversity or call 816-235-6704. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org.
Good morning, and welcome to the second half hour of, where are we? Jaws of Justice here in Kansas City on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. In the studio this morning with me, we have Ethan Thampy. And Ethan is Executive Director of Americans for Forfeiture Control Reform. Mm-hmm. And Amber Langston. Amber is with Show Me Cannabis. We'll also have joining us in just a moment, Mark Patterson, who is the executive director, founder of Cannabis Patients Network. And he's also been involved with forming a lot of other organizations when he lived in Kansas City, as well as John Payne will call in as well this morning. We've got a lot of discussion going on, and we wanted to catch people up in our little time of the world this morning. Good morning, Ethan. Good morning, Amber. Thanks for joining us in the studio. It's great to have warm bodies. Yeah, mm-hmm. Warm.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. I know we want to catch up real quick, so let me start. Amber, I know that you're familiar with what's going on with this language. Is this this is not the bill. This is petition language. Am I correct? Is this?
I'm on the board of directors for Show Me Cannabis.
Really quickly, let me tell our listeners. We're talking about cannabis issues this morning. Big surprise coming out of Jessica Thomas as well. And where we're at with legislation that's happening. We're trying to get some petitions on the ground so we can get some laws changed.
Right. So back in December, we submitted some language to the Secretary of State, which we submitted several different versions of essentially the same thing. And basically what it is to tax and regulate cannabis or marijuana like alcohol in the state of Missouri. It does set up there's a provision to set up a separate system for medical marijuana. There's also a provision to create a separate system for industrial hemp. So, we're going for the full guns here. And we got that language back from the Secretary of State's office recently. So they have to review everything and say this is valid. And then they create a summary, which is basically what you would see at the polling booth. So, there's like a little paragraph, and we just got that paragraph back with a fiscal note. There's different numbers that they say, but basically the fiscal note tells how much money that this would cost or save or earn Missouri. And our best number there was $217 million a year, so we were very happy with that one.
That is a pretty good number.
And now,
let me ask you really quickly, is this language now that that has been submitted and then it's going to go forward from there, is that set in stone, or is that going to change at all as it gets towards the actual date of
It's set in stone.
It is set in stone.
What we submitted to them is what we have to then submit to the people. So that's exactly what you'll see, the full language every time that somebody goes to sign it, whether or not they choose to read it all.
Right. So for our purposes, it's done.
Yes.
It's a done deal until this goes through either A, gets passed into a voting state where people get to vote on it.
Right.
Or it doesn't. So that's
right.
Where that's at.
So right now we're waiting for polling. We want to do polling of Missouri residents to make sure that this is viable. You know, it costs a lot of money to run these kinds of campaigns, and the people who donate it want to make sure that this is something that's going to work. So now that we have that specific language back, we can ask people if that's something that they would vote on that specific language. And so here in another week or so, hopefully John might have a better idea of the timeline on that. We should have some of that information back, and if it's good, we're going to go ahead and start getting signatures. If not, then we're probably going to continue to build our network and support group here in Missouri and work towards 2016 initiative to put on the ballot. In the meantime, though, we have a lot of things also in the works down in Jefferson City, which I can talk to you about. We have several bills. We have a couple of bills that have officially been introduced and several more bills that we are expecting to be introduced, and that includes actually a tax and regulate bill. We're expecting both the same bill in both the House and the Senate, which would have essentially the same language as one of the initiatives that we've put forward to the Secretary of State's office.
Right. So basically where we're at with things is we're on track. How do listeners now help at this process? How do they get involved to help this go through?
Well, right now, our big thing is calling our representatives, because we do have, the legislative session has started, and we've got a decriminalization bill and a medical bill that have been introduced in the House by Rory Ellinger. So these need to be assigned to committee. Once we get these other bills started, then we'll need to start calling representatives and asking them to have it assigned to committee, have the people on that committee vote for it, and so really push that way. In the meantime, always you can go to our website, and you should have our weekly newsletter. If you do not have that, you should definitely do that. Go to showmecannabis.com, and you can sign up for the weekly newsletter there, and that will keep you informed of all the activities we have going on around the state. And, just the weekly update of where we are in our processes.
And I think it's really important that we get involved. You're out there in the community and you don't like the way things are, so roll up your sleeves and put some elbow grease into this and get involved. With us on the phone, I want to get Mark Peterson involved. And Mark is one of the founding members from this area. He's also with the Cannabis Patients Network. Mark has also been videotaping patient stories and histories for 7.5 years, 8 years. Good morning, Mark. Are you there with us?
Morning.
Good morning, Mark.
How are you, Jessica?
I'm doing great. And what we're hearing now, did you hear the first part of the show where we're talking about what is going on is there. It's not changeable for this moment anyway, but this is what's happening.
I'm sorry, Jessica. I missed the first part of your show. I've been barraged by patients, and it's pretty much been the situation for us since moving to Colorado. Half a day, just about every day, is spent talking to refugees someplace in the country, and that today is no exception. And I'm sorry, I kind of came in a bit late there, so I have to kind of catch up.
No, you're great. Well, basically, first I need to let you know you're on the air, Mark. Is it okay to use you up here on the air?
Absolutely.
And you're calling, and where are you calling from, Mark?
I'm calling from Thornton, Colorado.
Awesome.
This is my new home. I'm 56 years, a Missourian. And as you said, the years I spent working for reform in Missouri, I formed Cannabis Patient Network in, actually unofficially in 2006 and officially in 2007. and worked towards reform there in Missouri and around the country from there. And then this past year, we along with my wife Regina Nelson, we moved to Thornton, Colorado, and from here we formed Cannabis Patient Network Institute, which is the next level of what we're trying to accomplish.
You are on the ground with the patient, so you know, really at the best possible scenario as a patient's wish list. What would you wish to see for the patients? And in a matter of legalization.
My wish list hasn't changed in years. And that's what I pressed for with the Show Me Cannabis Initiative and originally, and it's also what I've continued to press for ever since. For other states that have asked for my assistance, I've said the same thing over and over again. Number one, cannabis must be removed from the list of controlled substances.
Agreed.
That needs to be done on both a state and a national level. But I have been involved on the national level working with those who have been striving to achieve that goal nationally. But it must be achieved first from the state. I know some people want to argue about that, but we see the results after years and years of striving for this. The only way we can accomplish it is from a state level. Some states have begun that process. States like Iowa and Oregon have begun the process trying to move it down incrementally down the list of controlled substances. But as I have been stressing again for years, baby steps don't work. They don't work in policy, and they don't work in trying to change the issue regarding the Controlled Substance Act. And the primary reason is because currently it's in a Schedule One nationally, federally, and in most states. Moving it to a Schedule Two, a Schedule Three, or any other place on the schedule is a trap.
Yeah,
it'll make things even more difficult.
It definitely is, Mark.
When
you do go ahead and not reschedule it, it leaves a trap door open, and that is for sure. It does absolutely need to be rescheduled. A lot of people think that if you don't reschedule it,
it'll be fine. Please understand what I'm saying here. Mm-hmm. No, it does not need to be rescheduled. It needs to be removed entirely from the list of controlled substances. Cannabis has no place on the list of controlled substances.
Agreed,
it's a non-toxic substance. It does not belong on the list of controlled substances. That's been proven by factually and over again.
We understand that, Mark. Totally understand that. And you're right about it. It's not a rescheduling. It's taking you off the scheduling list. It is a plant. But where we're at with it at this point is we move forward from here. And we're looking for the best case scenario for what people are hoping that we can get done here. And let's approach this. This is what we got on the table right this moment. Let's go with this and try to
absolutely.
And united, we're going to get this thing done because it involves all of us. Can you just imagine the number of people that will get out of jail or out of prison or whose lives will be made easier when we get this done?
Yeah, Jessica, there's a couple other points need to be made here as well. Also, there needs to be protection for patients. Now, this is vitally important. We're beginning to see a lot of the problems incurred by this situation in Washington right now. There are those in Washington who are striving to try to eliminate a medical program altogether. Mm-hmm. The fallacy in this is that several things, and one of the things we've seen occurring here in Missouri, or could occur here in Missouri, and that is that undue taxation. We're seeing upwards of close to 30% increase in the taxes being put on cannabis here in Colorado right now. Fortunately for Coloradoans who are patients, there are protections from that taxation here. Unfortunately, in other states, we're not seeing that because it's not being put into the initiatives to protect patients from undue taxation. Now, I truly believe that it's wrong to put heavy excise tax on cannabis anyway, because excise tax are a sin tax.
Mm-hmm.
And cannabis is a non-toxic substance. It should not be treated that way. It should be treated like a crop, like corn, like any other crop, for so many reasons, because it's such a vitally important crop, not only to this, to the states, to this country, but also to the world. We need it. We need it for food. We need it for industrial purposes. We need it for so many different purposes. But the one thing that we're seeing so huge right now is the benefits medically.
Yeah,
and because of that, we have people dying. Of the people I've interviewed over the last 7.5 years, there's a number of them that are not with us anymore. Some of those people, if they would have had access to cannabis, very possibly would still be with us. So, you know, even if one life is sacrificed, that's wrong.
I agree.
That's wrong. No one should fall through the cracks.
You know, as well, I look at as the cannabis as an equal and opposite reaction to, say, Fukushima and this misery that's going on in the world. It's just kind of out of control. But to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And I see cannabis as like that reaction, the power and ability to heal a nation, not just to get us off of foreign oil, but our own oil addiction, which is, as we see, setting water on fire and fracking, you know, injecting chemicals into the earth to extract gas.
Well,
it could take us
fracking is a horrible thing out here right now.
It is. It's terrible. And they've got rights to dig underneath your home that you don't even know. And people don't even realize that they could come in and dig under your home. But that's a whole other show. But I've seen cannabis.
Jessica, you know what? It's very interesting that you made that statement, because understand, Cannabis Patient Network Institute was the only cannabis organization that had a booth at the Colorado State Fair, the only one that ever has had a booth, anyone in the cannabis industry that's ever had a booth at a state fair. While we were there in Pueblo, we were inundated with people who were sick. A lot of cancer,
a lot of
seizure disorders. We had people came up to our booth, their children having seizures right behind them, asking us for help, ways in which they can get help. While we're talking to them, I'm talking to some of the healthcare professionals who came up to our booth. I'm saying, how come we're seeing so much illness around us here? So many people sick. They rolled their eyes and they said, have you heard about all the fracking down here?
Right.
The fracking going on in the mountains?
And I know just recently.
I don't know if that is the direct cause, but there is something environmental going on even here in Colorado.
And I know just recently a physician was had ordered the ingredients of the fracking, the chemicals, to be, to let them know. They said it was a secret trade formula that they were allowed to keep it secret from doctors. But now I believe that ban was lifted so that physicians may know what is in the fracking chemicals, because the patients are getting ill. So there is some light coming. Some of this is coming to light, but not very much. But if you look at what the plant is capable of doing, planted in the ground can help to remove toxins and improve
Absolutely.
The soil and the air around us. And this is an equal and opposite reaction. You know, Mark, what I need to do is you and I need to get together and have a whole hour for ourselves, because we there's so much that we can hardly touch on, but I wanted to get, you know, from someone who's working directly with the patients, who's seeing, like, with patients out of time. They are out of time. A lot of people need this now. They can't wait another. They can't wait more years. They won't be here in years. But
Patients Out of Time is an organization that I work closely with. I'm on their advisory board. They hold events. Conferences in different places around the country. The next one's going to be in Oregon. Last one was in Tucson. One before that was in Rhode Island. And their faculty members are people like Raphael Mishulam, the guy who isolated THC in 1964. That's the kind of conference. And that's what we want. We want to work towards furthering the education and eliminating a lot of the misconceptions about cannabis. The biggest one is the fact that people have continued to take and make out that cannabis is toxic, and it's not.
No,
it's a non-toxic
substance. It's the opposite. It's cleaner.
Absolutely.
Man, you know, I got to let our listeners know that they're tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, and we got callers calling in. We got a pretty hot topic today. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you want to stay on the line, you're more than welcome to listen in. But we got to catch another call coming in, and
Absolutely.
We are limited on our time.
Thank you, Jessica. I'll always be around if you want me to call in again.
Awesome, Mark. We appreciate your help so much. And way to go.
No problem. Thank you.
Uh-huh. So even I know that there was like a statement made by our drug czar. Well, it's not the czar, the czarina.
Yeah, so I think what we're talking about here is last week, the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, Michelle Leonhardt, gave a speech to the National Sheriff's Association. This is intended to be a private speech, but apparently word of what Ms. Leonhardt said leaked out. And it turns out she made a rather sharp criticism of President Barack Obama's recent public stance on marijuana. He gave a, you know, the president recently gave a very good interview to the New Yorker in which he made a number of statements indicating that he is, his stance on marijuana and drug policy seem to be evolving, you know, including the statement that marijuana is safer than alcohol. That, you know, is something that the president is now on record as having said. So in the speech to the National Sheriff's Association, Michelle Leonhardt said several things in this vein that were deliberately disrespectful of the office of the President of the United States, if not blatantly insubordinate. And this is a big deal. You know, the DEA is an organization that has, at best, nominal congressional oversight, despite you know, being probably one of the most corrupt agencies in the federal government. You know, we know that they, for instance, recently we know that, you know, we found that it's been made public, for instance, that the DEA has been negotiating with the Sinaloa cartel for, you know, a long time.
And they're the biggest cocaine dealers.
The DEA is the biggest cocaine dealers in America, you know.
Yeah.
So despite all these, you know, scandals, none of them have really stuck, but perhaps this one will. It is, you know, I do not think that the president will tolerate this disrespect from someone he appointed to office and who serves at his pleasure. And I think it provides the national drug policy reform community, I think, an opportunity, a political opportunity, to maybe get some change at the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Yeah, I believe it is opening up that discussion where I know that, you know, high treason in any other country, they would be removed and put in the gulag. I guess that free speech is only applicable if you're hired by the president.
Well, you know, as a law enforcement officer who serves at the pleasure of the president, you know, she has to respect the chain of command. You cannot disrespect your superior.
Exactly.
You know, and there's a political angle here too. I think that Michelle Leonhardt was essentially lobbying a group of very important and politically powerful state officials, that is, sheriffs, to oppose marijuana law reform. Even the possibility of marijuana law reform, you know, as far, especially since now the president has, you know, begun making indications that his views are evolving and that change might be, you know, coming down the pipe.
Well, somebody needs to bring attention to it first. I'm sure that the attention has brought to it, but somebody needs to, in a formal way, say, "Hey, are you?" Mr. Obama, are you going to deal with this, or is this just okay for everybody to write out in front of you, oppose you? I mean, not just the House Speaker.
You know, both the President and Attorney General Holder have been making statements in the last year about the racial inequities of drug prohibition and the contribution that drug prohibition has brought to mass incarceration in this country. I think these are issues that the President and the Attorney General are beginning to really resonate with them.
I noticed that they.
We do have John Payne on the line, and I wanted to bring him into the conversation because he's probably sitting there patiently waiting and tapping his foot. But to continue on this issue, John, are you there? Good morning. You are tuned
in. Yes, I am.
All right. We're going to put you on the air, John. And you're calling us from St. Louis, am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And John is the executive director of Show Me Cannabis, the group that's represented here this morning. And John, you've been able to hear the discussion that's going on, and you know, we have our wish list for things that could happen, but it's not going to. This is what's happening right now, so we're going with that and running with that. But it even brings a real valid point. How do we address this to Mr. Obama and say, you know, this is subordination by one of your employees, which is kind of a renegade, runaway agency that's got a life of its own. It's kind of a monster that's taking its funding from the American people.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not a fan of Mrs. Leonhardt's comments, but I think the bigger problem is the role that the agency itself plays in our public policy, and that's, you know, we just even talked a little bit about the fact that they've been protecting Mexican cartels for over a decade now, but that just sort of scratched. That's just, you know, what they've been doing under the surface. What they've been doing even publicly, though, is, you know, an affront to democracy. They've basically said, well, you know, going back to what Mark was saying about scheduling, that marijuana is a Schedule I substance, and any attempts to change that, we're just going to refuse to let anyone change it. And so they've basically denied all science, denied all good common sense, and just said this has no medical value, this has a high potential for abuse, both of which are, you know, insane, and destroyed any attempts to make this a more rational policy. And so, you know, I think Mrs. Leonhardt's insubordination is bad, but what's really bad is what they've done for the last 40 years to harm public policy.
I mean, not only that, John, but I mean, you look at the issues that are going on, and I almost lost my train of thought. They're crap. I hate when that happens, because I wanted to let you finish that point. But, oh, yes, okay, so like Stevex or any of these synthetic drugs that are being manufactured and given to patients right now, all right, and a patent being held by our government and a patent being held by this drug company, yet we can still say on the books has no medical value. How can you even justify that?
Well, I don't know how they can justify it in any rational way, but that's, our federal government has had a long history of justifying things that are unjustifiable. So it's not necessarily going to make sense, but they can do it, and they have the power to make sure it sticks.
It's justified by the people who are making money off of it.
Or financially, really. That's kind of how it's gotten to be. It's a kind of an us versus them. Yeah, I'm sorry that it took us so long to get into the phone, but I would like to carry on this conversation with you at another time. We unfortunately only have about 2 minutes left to kind of wrap up this conversation. So in 2 to 3 minutes, could you tell us, John, what you'd like to see happening here and how people can help?
Yeah, sure. What I would like to see happen for Missouri is to give people a chance to vote on the legalization and regulation of cannabis in the state of Missouri. I hope that'll be 2014, but, you know, time is definitely short. We always sort of thought that 2016 was going to be the better year, but things just kept improving, it seems like, for 2014. So it's a possibility, but it's still probably the longer shot. But if people are interested in getting involved, as Amber said earlier, they can go to our website, showmecannabis.com. They can also text SMC for Show Me Cannabis to 42420.
Awesome. Thank you, John. Thank you for joining us. You can stay on the line here, or would you like to just listen to the show? It's either way. It's great with us, but we got to get wrapping it up here. So I wanted to try to get a closing statement from both of my guests here, Amber.
I'm thinking a lot about things that are going on in Jefferson City, so I really, really hope we can get signatures and get something on the ballot for, 2014. But short of that, there's a lot of exciting things happening. This tax and regulate bill, I mean, this is possible. They wouldn't pass it through the General Assembly. What they would do is hopefully just refer it to the ballot, so we wouldn't have to get all of those signatures. So that's actually a possibility. The other thing that is really something to have on your radar, everyone's radar, is hemp, industrial hemp.
Yeah,
on Friday, the American Farm Bureau came out with a policy position stating that they think that the federal ban on hemp should be removed. So this is a really huge win. This has been a sticking point for moving forward with hemp, and we're expecting bills introduced.
Wrap it up. Ethan, thank you so much. You've been so patient that you've been bringing these issues to. You've been listening to the Jaws of Justice here on 90.1 FM, KKPI, Kansas City's Community Radio. I'm Jessica Thomas. Thanks for joining us.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's all right, that's okay, cause I'm gonna
make my world a better place,
gonna keep that smile
on my face,
yeah, I'm gonna teach you.
enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. To find a link to audio of today's show, our calendar of events, and more, check out Jaws of Justice Radio on Facebook. To contact us, send an email to jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And to find out about future shows, check us out on KKFI's website, kkfi.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We thank our engineers, Joe Henderson and Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Flammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then, round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical. Today's outro theme music is Better Man from the Playing for Change Songs Around the World CD.
I'm gonna get back up. It'll be all right. It'll be okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Go keep that smile on my face. Go teach myself how to understand. Go make myself a better man.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following report comes to us out of the state of Pennsylvania.
Had a new push to legalize medical marijuana in Pennsylvania, and it's the first ever bill to receive support from both sides.
And tonight we're getting our first look at what's inside the bill that one lawmaker says could save lives. We're glad you're with us tonight. I'm Tanya Foster.
And I'm Rob Hanrahan. This is certainly a hot-button issue across the country. Mm-hmm. Right now, medical marijuana is legal in the states highlighted on your screen.
CBS 21's James Tully has been following the story since November. He joins us live now with new details on this. James.
Yeah, new details. There's language in this 34-page document that talks about the establishment of a medical cannabis board, medical cannabis ID cards, the creation of a compassionate care center, a place where marijuana can be stored and dispensed to patients. It's a big undertaking. But before you assume it's too steep a hill for this state to climb, let me show you who's behind this bill.
This is about educating people with the real facts.
Could this be the man who makes medical marijuana legal in Pennsylvania?
Sincerely, I have never felt more correct, more at peace on any piece of legislation I've introduced.
Republican Senator Mike Fulmer calls himself a conservative, Bible-believing Christian who startled even his own staff when he decided to put his name behind this medical marijuana bill.
This is the right thing to do. This has to happen.
What made you step across party lines to support this?
I started to look at the research, and I started to research it myself, and I found out that I was wrong, and that we were demonizing a plant that God put on this earth for us to have domain over and to take the benefits from.
And the senator also found a cause he really feels is worth fighting for.
These are all the children that are fighting epilepsy right now, that we know that it works.
Look closely at this picture at 16-year-old Diana Stanley.
It makes me feel like we have hope.
Her mother, Luann, one of hundreds of Pennsylvania parents pushing for medical marijuana.
I'm a father who simply wants that option for my son.
Back in November, a pharmaceutical company told me this.
There are certain molecules within the cannabis plant which appear to have very promising anti-epileptic effects.
Now Luann has seen the bill and feels like her crusade is starting to bear fruit.
Senator Fulmer, a very conservative Republican, is on our side, and I know with meeting with him on several occasions that he is not going to rest until he gets this passed.
So how confident are you in this bill passing?
I believe it can pass, and I just have to educate my fellow caucus members. I'm getting more positive feedback all the time.
Politicians for Pot. Who'd have thunk it? Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.